Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and this is part of our Secret History of the Internet series, in which we talk to people who were active in the online world pre-1994. And 1994 was a critical, pivotal year. That's the year that became obvious that, yeah, maybe we could commercialize this internet thing. And by 1995, we were off to the races with the Netscape IPO and Wall Street and the news media. Everybody was on board. But believe me, pre-1994, it was a rare person who saw the potential of the online world to have an impact on our lives. And one of the people who had that insight way back when and took concrete steps and action to bring the reality that we all live in today is Steve O'Keefe, and we have him with us today. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Ken. Good to be on your show.
And you know, Steve, I've interviewed you a lot, but we've always been narrowly focused on practical issues of internet promotion. And so today, what I'd like to do in this call is really talk about Steve O'Keefe, the man, you know, and your life, what led you to start experimenting with commercial applications on the internet. And of course, people that know Steve know that Steve is a bookman, been in the publishing industry for 30 plus years. He's got a beautiful book out, by the way, which I buy and share with all my friends. And I forget, Page on Fire?
Secrets of Successful Writers. Yeah, I love secrets. It's called Set the Page on Fire. And so Secrets of the Internet, this is a wonderful segue to that.
So Set the Page on Fire. I like Steve's book so much, by the way, that I give it to friends of mine who are already professional established writers, and they love it. But today we're going to talk about your life. So really biographical stuff, because what this series is about is capturing the historical record. No one's going to know how the internet became a commercial vehicle unless somebody, you know, gathers and organizes and the stories about how it happened. And believe it or not, it doesn't seem to be something that's being done. So we're going to do it in this series. For most people, it seems like the internet jumped from ARPANET to Facebook. And maybe Yahoo and
right.
Google, you know, and guys, it didn't happen that way at all. In fact, my thesis and my prejudice and my bias, and I'll lay it right down here, is that the internet was made real. Now, the technology obviously came from ARPANET, but it was made real by people like Steve and literally hundreds and thousands of people like him who said, hey, I think we can do something with this, and then went ahead and did it and led to this critical mass that we're now experiencing the benefits of today. So, Steve, I vaguely am aware that you're from Michigan.
Yeah, and let me fill in a little of that early part, because I think this is important to the story, is when I was in high school, I studied Fortran, and we had punch card computers in those days, so I'm pretty sure it was the Fortran language we were learning at that time. And computers were just brand new. And the computer lab that we had at my high school, and this is like 1975, I'm talking now, and it had you could design a program using punch cards, and then you had to complete a successful program, like telling a printer to print a document. You had to be able to do that to graduate this class. So I remember learning both COBOL and Fortran when I was one in high school, the other one in college. I took a class in computer programming at Michigan State University. And I just didn't find it that interesting at the time. Now, you know, that was on the threshold of tremendous breakthroughs in computing. But at the time, it was still something that was in a specialized lab. It hadn't made its way into the workplace. For example, in the workplace at that time, the dominant machine that you saw on people's desk was IBM Selectric typewriter. And IBM had sort of dominated the market for typewriters all over the world with these fabulous typewriters that allowed you to put a different font ball on. So you weren't for once limited to the keys that are on the typewriter. A normal typewriter has keys that have only one font on it. You want to do a different font, like italics, you'd have to get a different typewriter. And then that typewriter wouldn't do regular font. It would only do italics. But IBM put the type on a ball, and that ball would turn around and smack each letter against the platen, and that's how you typed in those
right
days.
That was
and it was really,
and that was state of the art.
That was very much state of the art, or really what you saw, front end offices, you know, a serious office managers and administrative assistants are on IBM Selectrics. I worked setting a newsletter for the Michigan Libertarian Party on an IBM Composer in those days. And that started me down the road of typesetting, and typesetting also started me down the road into books, and which, as you've mentioned, is my background. But I thought one of the most interesting things is I'm a writer, and I really started as a professional writer the same time I started playing with computers, which is when I was 15. And I found out that the people in the same computer class where we were making the punch cards, they would pay me 25 cents a page for pornography that I would write at that time. So I started writing. My first paying gig as a writer was writing porn for my classmates in the first year of high school. And the computer lab was where we passed around the latest installments. So, you know, it was sort of the commercialization was there from the beginning for me. And I went on to find more reputable ways of making money as a writer, you know. But at that point in my life, you know, there were very few things that people thought I could do that was worth money. And one of them was write stories. So,
well, 14-year-old boys have a very limited aesthetic palette. So to place you in time, I mean, I graduated from high school in 77, college in 81. Based on this Selectric story, I'm guessing you're roughly the same age? Or
yeah, school when, 77, when, I graduated at college in 82.
Okay, we're right in the zone. Just to give young people a perspective, when I was in high school, and Steve, you'll concur with this, the Selectric ruled. When I went off to college, if you wanted to word process, you had to bring yourself to the computer center, which in my case was about a mile from the regular campus. And you had to work through some crazy interface that I never could figure out. There was only one guy in my graduating class of 1,200 people who wrote his thesis on a computer, which he wrote it on the mainframe, and he did it just to be contrary. You know, he did it for the experience of doing something unusual. And then 4 years later, I had my Macintosh. So we really went from, you know, from kites to balloons to jet aircraft really, really fast. So
yeah, it was super fast. And then in college, I recall that most people, if they were well outfitted in college, they had an electric typewriter. And if they weren't well outfitted, they had a manual typewriter. And that was kind of a dividing line there. And also in college, I made a good deal of money as a writer, just writing term papers for people who weren't good at English. And I found out that paid better than porn at college, was be able to help somebody get a passing grade in English class. And so really, I wrote about 20 papers a week when I was in college.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. you really cranked it out.
Yeah, I typed all the time. I was a very fast typist, and that, you know, speaking of being a fast typist, people have realized that my boss, who I'm getting ahead of the story, but I worked for a publisher called Lumpanics, and the publisher, he was drafted in Vietnam, and he was sent to the front line, and when they found out that he could type 60 words a minute, they pulled him back to the office, and he never got shot up as a result of his typing skills. So there's a lesson for youngsters in school today. Learn how to type.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. You know, Not to take this on its tangent, but my dad avoided combat almost the same way. He passed an aptitude test for engineering, and they sent him to engineering school instead of to the front line.
Yeah.
Yeah, guys, Steve just gave you a very valuable lesson. So amazing. So you went from writing porn to being basically an academic paper factory. You were just cranking
it out. I was a lab, more or less. And then at the time, I was an ambitious writer getting poetry published, and I studied under Diane Wachowski. She's one of the great Black Sparrow poets, one of the last of the Beat generation. And she's still living today, I believe. She's got to be well into her 90s. And I wrote short stories and got those published, too. I don't think I ever got paid for my writing except for, you know, term papers and then writing on the Libertarian Party's newsletter and some their propaganda. And when I left college, I moved out west. And that was fortuitous because the internet was further along out there. And I moved first to Seattle. And that is where in 1987, I bought my first modem. It was a 300 baud modem. 1987, that was. And in 87, what did I use this modem for? Well, it allowed customers to send their typesetting. I used it for typesetting. So I could take jobs in over the phone lines. Then we would code the jobs, and then we would run it through the typesetter. So nobody had to re-keyboard the text any longer. This is a major, major development in typesetting, really in the history of print and other things. Once there was data storage on a typesetter, no one had to re-keyboard text. And up until probably 1985, I'm guessing, anytime you wanted to change anything, you had to re-keyboard or re-output at least a line or two of type and paste it over the old version. There's simply no other way around this. There was no data storage, so you couldn't store documents. I know this is hard to believe, that we went from not only no type fonts or any of that stuff, no data storage, no place, nothing that stored your keystrokes. And so that was maybe one of the most important innovations, was a hard drive, having a place to store keystrokes and store documents so that they could be updated and then reused without having to be recreated every time.
Let me just give young I'm thinking about young people on this call for some reason, to give them a little perspective. In 1984, I had a business teaching speed reading, and I made a flyer, which I had typeset, and I didn't proofread it very well, and I got something wrong in the flyer. The typesetting fee was $100, which was at that time half of my monthly rent. And when I went to the typesetter, it was another $100 bill to get that one thing changed on a flyer. So that's where life, that's what life was like before this innovation that Steve just described.
Yes, and because of that, it really also limited people's access to publishing. So you couldn't, there was no self-publishing movement before then, really, because there was no access to the technology. It was, you had to squeeze yourself through an agent and an editor into a normal publishing house, and you had to meet their standards or you couldn't get your book out. That was it. There were gatekeepers, like with much of the media. And then those gatekeepers just disappeared if you wanted to publish. And you know what this was like. In the late 1980s, you would walk around town and you would see flyers for garage sales, and they would have outline 3D shadow type on them. That was like one of the only eight fonts that you could have on a dot matrix printer at that time, were these very, I really feel like the graphics of that era so date themselves, because there's just no other time. There was just a brief moment in time where we were all forced to use these ugly fonts on everything we did. And then that quickly disappeared into a more design-friendly universe. But in the late 80s, that's what people printed on. So there were computers. There just wasn't an internet. And the computers at that time were like CPM computers. I had a K-Pro 2, I think, was my first computer. Trash 80s were TRS Radio Shack. Trash 80 was a standard computer at that time. And they ran on, I believe it was called CPM, and was the software. Geez, all this stuff is even hard to remember. And because the movement, Moore's Law, who's the brilliant engineer at Intel, who Gordon Moore, who came up with this thing that the cost of technology halves about every 18 months. And it was expressed initially as the number of transistors that you could fit onto a chip. But it's just basically become shorthand for technological progress. Now, it's not really a law, and it doesn't really apply to everything. But in those years, it's pretty reliable that the same computing power 18 months down the road was going to cost you half as much. So if you wait out the market a little bit, then you know that in 2 years, it's going to be one quarter as much. And people who saw this exponential curve of capability to cost realized that pretty soon you would be able to get every bit of knowledge in the universe on something like the head of a pin. And that's more or less, we've moved pretty close to that in the years since. But at that time, the modem, which stood for modulate, demodulate, and it sent over the phone lines, it sent sounds that turned into text on the other side or turned into characters. And so this is a way of transmitting files. So all the link-ups on modems were one-to-one. You weren't really linking up one-to-many. And there wasn't like an internet to go attached to. But there were things called bulletin boards in the late 80s. And these were amateurs, you know, like us, who had a modem and realized that they could make their modem like a public square. And so they called them bulletin boards. And I remember at the time I was in the early 90s, I was working for the book publisher Lumpanix in Port Townsend, Washington, and they had a book by Keith Wade called The Anarchist's Guide to the BBS. And BBS was bulletin board systems, and that was probably the first forerunner of a internet book that I worked on, was this guy telling people how to use bulletin board systems, how to find them, what you could do with them. And they were like, I don't know, going even back further into the vault when people had landline phones and they sometimes had party lines, or you had a special number, you could dial in a certain number and all of a sudden you'd be attached to a group call. And all your friends would be on the same call and cracking jokes and other things. They called them either party lines or party numbers. And so that was sort of like what a bulletin board was like before they had a modem, was You would literally call up this group number. You never knew who was on there or where they were from. People are always trying to hook up. It was always a little bit mysterious and scary, you know. And so bulletin boards were the same way initially. They were sort of neighborhood oriented and they were mostly computer enthusiasts, people building their own computers out of Heathkit kits or Radio Shack. So this was the beginning really of the proletariat reaching out and touching each other through this new device. And
if I could just give people a little context too, it was largely a local phenomenon because you literally had to dial a phone number to reach the computer. So people would typically want to use bulletin boards within their area code. Otherwise, you could end up with some ferocious phone bills, because that was also an era, and young people might find this amazing, when long-distance phone calls were really, you could bankrupt yourself with long-distance phone calls in the 80s. Literally.
That's right. I was in college, and one of the people in the co-op I lived in had a boyfriend in Iran at the time, and the revolution was going on, and she was like very worried for him. Well, she ran up about $600 a month in phone bills to Iran, and at the time it cost about $300 a month to live there. So, you know, it was twice her housing cost was her phone bill. And so, yeah, you can't imagine today how much grief that people would suffer over long-distance calls. You know, every single call was scrutinized, call the phone company and challenge them on all stuff, cut your bill down. People can't imagine doing that now.
So the bulletin boards were typically local. You would probably log on, if you lived in Seattle, to the Seattle bulletin boards. And
right.
The other thing, too, and you referred to this, the computer, the home computer for the bulletin board, had to have as many modems as it wanted to have simultaneous users. So in other words, for there to be four people on the BBS simultaneously, there had to be four physical modems attached to that computer.
That's right. And
right?
There may have to very well be four phone lines, because you couldn't use the same phone line at the same time with two different modems. It just wouldn't work. So
imagine, guys, if to build a website, you had to buy a computer, buy 12 phone lines, 12 different modems, just so that you could have 12 people on your website at the same time. That's what it was like in the late 80s when Steve first got involved.
It was sort of crazy. And, you know, I had moved from learning on an IBM Composer to typeset to learning on real typesetters to watching typesetting equipment migrate through to being computerized typesetting. They called it computerized typesetting at the time. That was big news. You know, CompuGraphic was the name of the ruler of computerized typesetting then. And I feel sorry for that whole industry because it just went through wrenching changes every few years. All their technology became outdated. And me, I had started a typesetting business in Seattle and with my wife, and we had benefited from the modem and being able to take in jobs over the phone lines, big catalogs and things like that, big product lists. You can imagine the old price lists and phone books where they used to have to set every single item in that book every single time you print it. You couldn't save any of it. That was, you know, just the miracle of being able to save something to a drive was so revolutionary and cut costs so much. And then eventually we ended up not just riding the digital revolution, but being ridden over by it because people stopped using typesetters. Like you said, it cost you $110 to go get one change made in a one-page flyer. And all of a sudden people could do that with their home computer, their home printer. And that came about right at the end of the 1980s. And it really just put a lot of typesetting businesses completely out of business, which it should. That's what innovation should do. But you see how I thought at one time I was on the front end of that, and then I ended up realizing I was on the back end of that, and I got killed. So in a matter of probably 8 years, I went from vanguard to has-been in typesetting with modem. And that's sort of the arc that destroys so many other businesses and is busily at work destroying the whole publishing profession and writing profession now, because a lot of the writing is being done by AI now. So, but I'm now getting way ahead of the story. And on the internet part, I'll say I moved up to Port Townsend and back to Port Townsend after this business went bankrupt on typesetting, and went back to work for Lumpanix Unlimited, that counterculture publisher there in Lumpanix, which was at that time kind of a hippie town. You know, it wasn't as high-end as it is now. And that's because you couldn't telecommute. You still couldn't telecommute in 1990. There wasn't a way for you to get your email or get your assignments or even really communicate with people long distance efficiently. So I was back on the Olympic Peninsula, and when I went back, there was this new business in town called Olympus.net, and Olympus.net sold you internet access. They were an internet service provider. Nobody even knew what to call them then. ISPs is what they decided to call them. And so I joined. I was probably one of the first 10 people on the internet on the Olympic Peninsula. And over the next couple of years, it grew to about 100 people or so. So, like you say, 94 is the tipping point. Before 94, you know, people didn't have email addresses, more or less. It was still a novel thing to have an email address. And so when I was on OlympusNet, I used to have to still pay to access the Well in San Francisco, which is a network that where I met you. And the Well stands for Whole Earth Electronic Link, and it was put together by like Howard Reingold and Stuart Brand. And it was a bulletin board writ big. So it worked just like a bulletin board. You had to dial in from outside. You could get mail in the service using a system of commands called Pine, which was very geeky at the time. And that's where I first learned about things like handles, that you had handles on the internet. You didn't have a name because everything had to be limited to 8 characters. So I think you were Ken Mack on there. And
that's right.
Howard Reingold was HLR, and John Lepkowski was Johnl. J-O-N-L, and I was Lumpanix, L-O-O-M-P-A-N-X, and, you know, everyone had to limit their name to 8 characters or less. So that was, you know, you couldn't have space bands in your name. There were a lot of rules, like you couldn't have dots in your name at that time because they meant something in the command system. So, you know, why would you do this? Well, you would do it to find people like you, Ken. I would, from Port Townsend, Washington, the cultural life of the city, nice as it might be, it's really not a lot of people to talk to there, 7,500 population. I get on the well, and here are all these people from all over the world, really, largely San Francisco-oriented, but also really throughout the United States and the world. And they're discussing things that I think are completely fascinating. And that's all you can do, really, on the well at that time was discuss. And they had forums and people put up messages. All this seems like old hat now with Facebook. But in those days, this was sort of brand new. And you could meet people that had similar interests. Like, Ken, you love jazz. I love jazz. And you know, we first met on the well, but we never met in person until many years later, probably in New Orleans. And there you love jazz. I love jazz. We talked about doing some video projects together down there. So really, many of the people I have met on the well have stayed as friends throughout my life and have been important partners on a variety of projects. I was a writer at that time. I wrote for Boing Boing. I wrote for a thing called Hot Wired, which was the first online version of Wired. But even before those, when we were on the well in 92, I was also on Genie. Many people aren't aware of that network, and that was put out by General Electric. And it's a capital G, capital E, then lowercase N-I-E. Genie was their online network. And Prodigy also had an online network at that time. And I think Prodigy was run by Sears, wasn't it, at one time?
See, it was a weird alliance of Sears, IBM, and GM. I mean, it was kind of crazy.
Some tax firm was in there, like, you know, H&R Block, I think at one time was a part owner of Prodigy. And so these things, like you say, they're lost in history. Like, I don't even know what happened to Genie and Prodigy, and I don't really care. I'm sure I have logins for them. But they were the forerunners that then in 94, everything shifted. AOL came online. I don't know exactly when AOL came on. It might have been 93 or 92. CompuServe at that time was a competitor to AOL, and it was CompuServe that ended up being bought by H&R Block, and it ended up being sold to America Online, and they killed it. But CompuServe at one time was the business person's internet. Do you remember that? And
AOL was your
family internet, and CompuServe was where you went if you were serious, you know. And so many, many people did I meet through these forums on CompuServe, forums on AOL. You'll remember some of these people like Bob and Varda Novick. Rosalind Resnick used to run one of the big internet forums on America Online. John Audette, you might remember him from And at that time there was a thing called Club Wired. And Netspace was a thing that was run by Sony at that time. So it was just, everybody was trying everything. And
can I just throw something in here? I think it's really important, again, for young people. When you were on CompuServe, that was it. Like, you couldn't go from CompuServe to AOL to Prodigy. You're like, you know, now you can bounce from website to website.
These are all walled gardens, which are coming back into fashion.
Yeah, they were like islands, right? And you had to, you know, log off one and then log on to the other one. And so
some of them you paid per month or per year. And they were all separate groups. So, for example, in 1990, well, let's even go before 94. In 93, I was promoting a book called Secrets of a Super Hacker for the publisher Lumpanix. And so for me then, this was the beginning of commercialization for me, was, okay, there's all these people discussing computer security online that will definitely want to know about this book. But I just can't go into these forums, which restrictions on commercial messaging, and say, buy this book. They'll beat me up and kick me out. So, but at the same time, they want to know about this book. So what I did was I started providing excerpts from the books for these forums. And so instead of going in and saying, buy this book, I would go in and say, I have a free excerpt from this new book to offer you. If you want it, send email to this address, and thank you very much. It was a very short message offering a free excerpt from a new book. And for because these messages were seen as contributory to the forum.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to a forum on computer security and hacking, and there's a new book on computer security and hacking out, you kind of want to know about it, but you have to know about it in a certain way. And what did we call that? We called it netiquette. And netiquette. You remember that?
I do. I haven't heard that word in 20 years.
Yep. It's the unwritten protocol of the internet, and it sort of said it's not okay to put commercial messages into these forums. And some of the forums made that explicit, like it's against the terms of our forum. You have to apply for membership. We will kick you out if you don't observe the rules. So some of the forums, like discussion groups on American Line and CompuServe, were run with moderators. They were moderated forums, and others were called unmoderated forums that were open to anyone. But you could still violate terms in unmoderated forums. They still weren't just open to anything. And so there was a law firm that came along and said, you know, there's really no law against us just throwing an ad for our legal services inside of every one of these discussion groups. And they wrote some software to put their ads into discussion groups. And the stuff hit the fan. And that was Cantor and Siegel were the names of the two attorneys. You recall them?
Yeah. Oh, that was such a scandal when that happened. That was the story of the internet for 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest defining moments of this thing, in that people couldn't stand these attorneys and they couldn't stand their ads, but at the same time, there was no way for them to effectively kick their ads off. And so it basically forced forums to become moderated, because if you weren't moderated, you'd just be subject to a tsunami of spam. Which the term spam, I think, came out shortly after Cantor and Siegel. It was probably coined to define their activity of reproducing the same message in every single forum on the internet over and over and over again. You know, and so they were just ruining the internet by flooding it with these messages for their law firms, and there seemed to be no way to get rid of them. And, you know, at that time, this, I think, probably made the cover of Time magazine. And these attorneys were subject of vigilantism. People tried to destroy them personally and professionally. They, you know, we didn't know about things like anonymous strangers sending death threats to the internet until Cantor and Siegel demonstrated how that was done. And people hated them so much, and they took them to court. And, you know, they won. I believe they won all of their cases, or they never had any significant defeat in saying, look, I can put whatever I want on there. If you don't want me to, lock me out. You know, make it a membership, you know, have some terms. And that really did sort of bring in, like, there's a thing called Usenet news groups, and these were places where people would discuss topics, and they had strange names like alt.space.mars.colonization, you know, and it would be for a discussion group for colonizing Mars, but all the news groups were in this hierarchical dot pattern of ordering. And there were some 40,000 of them, and people could just go and post messages and receive messages. They were really a lot of fun, open discussion groups, and then these became choked with spam, and then they became moderated. And now they still sort of exist, and they sort of exist in the form of Reddit. Reddit is really sort of like Usenet news, moderated Usenet news groups.
That was such an important part of
1994.
You're still not in 1994, exactly. So to bring people back, you were in Port Townsend, which is a little town, kind of remote.
Side village. I was one of the first 10. And at that time, I was one of the, say, 100 or so subscribers on our local internet service provider. And, you know, and those days, I knew him by name. His name was Ned, and I would go over to his place. He had a garage behind his house where all the servers were. So it's just, it was just that down-home friendly. And in 94, I lost my job for that publisher that I loved so much, Lumpanix, the Outlaw Press. And I just hung out my own shingle as I do internet publicity services for book publishers and authors. And there was still no Mosaic browser yet. So people kind of didn't know exactly what I meant. And what I meant was I will go to CompuServe and find the forums where people are talking about things related to your book, and I'll post an offer to give people a free excerpt. And I'll do that on America Online, and I'll do it on Genie, and I'll do it on Prodigy. And when you add up all these forums together, wow, your book got mentioned in about 100 different places on the internet, and resulting in, who knows, hundreds or thousands of people downloading excerpts, and maybe one or two flames. So I got good at knowing the rules and fighting the flamers, because you can do publicity, but again, you have to follow netiquette or they'll just throw you out. And it doesn't matter whether the law is on their side or not. If you're banned, if you're blacklisted, you can't do anything. So the law may very well agree with you, but good luck getting somebody in Bermuda to take you off of a server that says you're a jerk, you know. And they pass that list around hourly to everyone on the internet. And you can be banned, you can be just banned from touching anything within a matter of minutes. And so, you better watch your P's and Q's out there.
So you took what you learned working at Lumpanics, what you figured out working at Lumpanics, which was,
right,
gee, we can use this online world to systematically and deliberately promote a book. And something that I think needs to be said that people may not be aware of, not only was there a sort of social netiquette going on the various boards, it was legally prohibited to carry out commercial activities on the internet until it wasn't. I mean, there was an actual change
in the
law.
It was prohibited.
So for people to really appreciate what you and others did was you were operating in a sphere where doing anything commercial was not only frowned upon, but in some cases banned, prohibited, outlawed, illegal, right?
Yeah.
So you got your feet wet in this new world at Lumpanics, I was a subscriber to the Lumpanics catalog. When that thing arrived, it was a happy day for me. It had all kinds of wild and crazy books. Someone should do a documentary just on the history of Lumpanics, but that's another issue. But you ended up at Lumpanics. You figured out, hey, we can use these online discussion boards and resources to let people know about a book. Your first book, again, that you had a success with was the hacker book. What was
publicity on? Well, at Lumpanics, it was Secrets of a Super Hacker, and
the author's
name was Nightmare.
And that was your first big hit in terms of being a book publicist online. Is that right?
That's right, because prior to that, I had used the internet, the bulletin boards, the Well, and these discussion groups to find authors and to find translators and to find illustrators. So I had, up to that point, I had mostly been using it, I guess, from supply side. You know, I'm out there looking to buy, looking to find people and to spend money. And then it shifted with that book, really, it shifted to, because we got a good review of the book, and I asked permission to reprint the review online, which was something you had to ask for permission for in those days. And I'd get permission, and I would go reprint the review in these discussion forums. Okay, now, posting a review of a book is not a commercial activity. It is a educational activity. So as long as you're not including a sales pitch, which I would not include with it. But when we posted the reviews of that book in all these computer security forums all over the place, well, literally the next day, our fax machine, and we still had one, it started humming with orders from all over the world for this book on computer security. In fact, we had orders from Saudi Arabia, from the government of Saudi Arabia. We sold over 20 copies to the NSA in D.C. So a lot of police departments and, you know, we're just first having to deal with the issue of hackers. You know, computers had been around a while. The internet was relatively new, but already people could tell that you had to protect against hackers with your data on your computer.
Do you happen to remember any of the numbers, like how many copies got sold? But this was clearly a unignorable phenomenon, right? I mean, you posted
we sold 40,000 copies of the book in 2 years. But what got me was it was literally minutes after a review would get posted that the orders would just start coming in. It was that one-to-one, you know. And Jeff Bezos talked about how in the early days of Amazon, they had a bell ring every time an order came in. And, you know, at first, they would cheer when that bell rang. And then they had to disconnect the darn thing because it was so annoying. So that's the sort of aha moment that comes when you realize that all these interconnected computers, there's people on the other end that are watching. And when they see something they like, they respond, and they respond immediately. And it was that ability to be so fast. And the other thing I want to mention along with that is I also used the internet to ask people to review books. So I would pitch journalists via email. Email was a relatively new thing at that time. In 1994, Seth Godin published a book called Email Addresses of the Rich and Famous. And this was, he outed hundreds of famous people's email addresses. And that was before the World Wide Web, before really, it was when having an email address was still a geeky thing. You didn't necessarily tell people. You didn't put it on your business cards. And so I realized how powerful these email addresses were. And I thank Seth now, and I thanked him then. I took all those addresses and put them in my database. He had, like, the personal email address for Steve Wozniak and Bill Gates and for Supreme Court justices and for, you know. And one of the ones that was sort of famous that got him in trouble was he published Siskel and Ebert Go to the Movies. Roger Ebert was sort of a techie, geeky guy, and his email address got published in there, and he just got so slammed, he was furious with Seth Godin for that. Interesting. And that was before Seth wrote Unleashing the Idea Virus and Permissions Marketing, you know, these books which are now just fundamental bedrock texts about using the internet.
Oh my goodness, that was before he was at Yahoo. That was before he had his game company. He came out of publishing himself, right, Seth?
Exactly. Pretty sure. He worked at Calder Books for years. Michael Calder, who runs, it's the snarky book publishing agent site. I can't think of it now for some reason. I think it's called Publishers Weekly or something, not Publishers Weekly. Frustrating. I don't go there often because it's a membership site and I don't pay to participate. So the stuff I can see isn't that interesting.
Gotcha. But the point I want to make though is that
Seth Godin, and Seth had written 60 some books before he wrote Unleashing the Idea Virus. So he was a great consumer and repackager of ideas, you know. He sort of had something like the Four Dummies series before the Four Dummies series, where they covered, it was the same series covering all different kinds of topics from, you know, sort of every person's view. It didn't take off quite like Dummies series did, which I was involved in really from the beginning on the Dummies. But he was a seasoned writer, and then he helped all of us learn how to use the internet with some integrity and some style. You know, you want people to pay attention to you, be funny. That always helps.
Yeah.
So this was all in the cusp. And then I started my own business doing this internet PR. And I went to New York from Port Townsend in fall of 1994. And I had meetings with, like, the head of publicity for 15 different book publishing companies. A friend of mine, my mentor, Alice Atchison, opened up a Rolodex, and I managed to get meetings with over a dozen major publishing company heads of publicity. And I was looking for work as a freelance book publicist, not as an internet publicist. But fortuitously, the Wall Street Journal ran a front page story on Mosaic and how it was going to change the internet and the world as we know it. And that ran on like October 14th, and like two weeks later, I was there in town to talk to these publishers. And in meeting after meeting, I would say, you know, I do, you know, television PR and magazine PR and print PR and radio PR. And then there was just one little tiny paragraph at the end of my resume. It says, I also have a unique service promoting books on the internet and other online services. And so in interview after interview, they only asked me about that. They did not ask me about any of the other stuff. I couldn't believe it. It was like they were coordinated, you know. And so they say, well, what do you do for books on the internet? And really, it was like a total brain drain. I had to come across with everything I do. I'd say, well, I prepare an excerpt, and I prepare it in the right format. And then I go find these discussion groups, and then I go post these offers for the excerpt, and then I go respond to those, and then I email journalists and ask them to review it, and then that's what we do. And they were like, great, this is great. So I went home from that 2 days of whirlwind meetings thinking, that's it, I got a new business. And I got rid of all the other publicity stuff, and I just took that one paragraph about promoting books online, and I turned that into a whole business model and a company, and that company then just grew like gangbusters. So it was slow at first. None of these publishers sent me a job for months, and I thought they were just fooling with me. They shined me on while I was there in their offices, but then they never sent me anything afterward. But on literally on Christmas Eve 94, I got a call from HarperCollins. They wanted me to do PR for a book called Masters of Deception by Josh Quitner and Michelle Slatawa, which was about a hacker. I can't remember his name now. He was quite famous at the time. He was America's most notorious hacker. And Slatawa worked for Time magazine, and Quitner, I think, worked for something like the New York Times. So the two of them were married. They were a couple, and they were both high-level journalists, and they were both onto this hacking thing. Well, the campaign took off, and during the time that I was promoting it, they arrested this hacker, Kevin Mitnick. That's who it was.
Kevin Mitnick.
He was a little bit famous at the time. And they arrested him, and thanks to the internet, I had a news release that I had the two experts on this guy who'd been tracking him for years available for interview, and I could send that news release via email. I didn't have to use fax or print or whatever people used prior to that. I emailed about 300 journalists that I had this, and we got on NBC Nightly News that night with these two experts off of that email news release, which I could have, you know, he was arrested, and 3 hours later, the journalists had this news release on in their inbox. You know, and in those days, there wasn't a lot to compete with it in their inbox. So we got great pickup on that. And then HarperCollins signed me to a 7-book deal in the first quarter of 1995. And then I started doing work for Wiley and Dummies and Random House Children's Publishing and Dr. Seuss and you name it. Everybody wanted their books promoted on the internet, and I was really the only one there to go to.
And I want to emphasize so that to people. So Steve, let me, if they don't mind, I just want everybody to grasp this because you could miss it very easily, and it's a little hard to wrap your mind around it. Steve was the first person on Earth to promote books in a systematic way on the internet. He was the first guy. And I think there's another important part of your story, too. There was another practitioner of online publicity since passed away, unfortunately, Eric Ward. Tell a little bit about your deal with Eric Ward on how you were going to divide the earth, because there was a time when there was only Steve O'Keefe and Eric Ward even thinking about online publicity. Like, no, you know,
yeah.
I mean, maybe other people think, maybe people were thinking about it, but in terms of, as you put it, hanging up a shingle and doing it as a profession, there were two guys in the whole world. And what was your, do you remember, you told me the story, I thought it was hilarious, the deal that you made with Eric.
We had a sort of a pact because we had been talking to each other for years about building these media lists of journalists. And so he had a big list, I had a big list, Paul Krupin is another guy that had a big list. And we were all in communication with each other, but Eric was, like me, in business doing this. And so we would get these calls, and you'd be surprised who would call. So I was there one day, and I got a call. I think it was from Jerry Yang. It was from Yahoo. And they wanted me to handle their online PR. And I said, I only work for book publishers. You should see Eric Ward. Talk to Eric Ward. And so they'd call Eric Ward, and so he ended up doing Yahoo's work. And then anytime he got a book publisher, like Random House came to him and said, we need some help on the internet. And he'd say, you have to go see Steve O'Keefe. And so the deal was he'd send all his book publishing people to me, inquiries, and I'd send everything that wasn't book publishing to him. And so we were there for about 2 years. If you just said, I would like to get a message to people on the internet. How do I do that? Well, you had to either go see Eric Ward or me. And there were just, it's not because we had a monopoly. It's just because we were the first two out there that anyone could find that could do this for them or tell them how to do it. And that led to my book, which I wrote in 96. It came out in 97, Publicity on the Internet, and that was a huge book at the time. It was a total game changer for the way people approached online public relations. They approached it more professionally, I would say, afterwards, and less crassly than they had before then. They realized things like filtration and banning can get you locked out for life. And there's a good example of Conde Nast. They got locked out of, it was the Associated Press's news stream. So because they're the junior people at Conde Nast, who understood how the internet worked, were spamming the journalists at Associated Press to get coverage for, you can imagine how many stories Conde Nast has breaking at one time. If you have 100 magazines, you've got 100 cover stories. So there's a lot of PR generated behind the scenes at these publications. And so if you're slamming journalists at AP with news releases, email news releases, they're eventually going to bozo filter you, which was a word that we hadn't heard before, bozo filter. And that just says any email coming from John Bozo goes immediately to the trash. So you can bozo filter people on an individual basis. You can do it company-wide. And you can do it internet-wide by putting them on a blacklist. And so what happened was because the young and eager people at Conde Nast were sending sports stories to fashion editors and fashion stories to sports editors and cooking stories to hard news editors, they irritated so many people at AP that they got banned company-wide. So now, all of a sudden, you can imagine, if you're used to 20 AP stories a month or something, and it goes to zero. There were zero communications between anyone at Conde Nast or with a Conde Nast email address and anyone at Associated Press or with an AP email address. It was a blanket ban. So Conde Nast's CEO had to go to D.C. and beg forgiveness from the Associated Press to do training on internet netiquette and technique. And really, they barely got off of the banned list. And that's when companies started hiring people like me so that they would not have a bad misstep. And,
wow.
And so my business went from... It really scaled up, as I told you. All of a sudden, I was the only guy doing book PR, and I just had to try to keep up with the demand. And we were doing, I had a team at one time of 9 people launching 200 books a year. So that was a news release going out virtually every working day. And that was a frantic pace. And that was before the dot-com bubble burst, which, you know, that was the 2000, basically 1999. And it all went, all kind of went, it imploded, I guess I would say.
Well, you know,
that's past the origin.
internet.
Yeah, a 9-person internet company was actually a big internet company in those days.
It was. And I sold my firm to an even bigger company called Tanagra, which was in Houston at the time, and they were an internet marketing firm that builds websites, and I did the PR and the publicity work. And they were the ones that ended up imploding, not me. And I went back to writing a sequel to that book called The Complete Guide to Internet Publicity in 2002 that came out. And that sort of was like the graduate course. That's everything I could pull out from having worked in that crucible for those 8 hot years from 1992 to 2000 was in that second book. And I guess some things I haven't mentioned that I would like to mention, mailing lists. Do you remember how important mailing lists were at one time?
Mm-hmm.
There was a site called Lyst, L-I-S-Z-T, like the composer, and it just had... Mailing list was like a private discussion group where you could you'd be a member and you would get the newsletter mailed to you. It's just sort of, I guess it would be called a newsletter now. And they were very open, very interesting, very active ways. John Audette, who I mentioned earlier, ran one on internet marketing. He ran the internet marketing list for a long time. Let's see, who are some of the others that were out there? Ed Kroll, The Whole Internet. Do you remember The Whole Internet?
Oh, my God. Such an important book.
Yeah. That was like the only book that people associated with the internet for about 2 years. And I think that came out in like 94, before the World Wide Web.
I mean, there were no books originally, and so his was sort of the only game in town. Hey, I want to go to a very important story that I think people are going to find really interesting. When was it that Steve Bezos called you up and said, hey, Steve, how do you sell books on the internet?
Yes, and I didn't know him at the time. I knew of him. This was in 1995. And sort of to set the stage, I think he knew me because I covered the book publishing industry for Internet World magazine. I don't know if you remember Internet World. It was pretty much as a glossy news track magazine about the internet. And I covered the publishing beat for them. So I would do things like review online bookstores and talk about how publishers were adapting to the internet. And I think Jeff got to know of me through my columns in Internet World. And I had my business, Internet Publicity Services, and one of my bigger clients was a company called Bookstacks Unlimited, and I think they were in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and they were at the time the world's largest online bookstore. Now, this is funny because nobody remembers Bookstacks Unlimited now, but, you know, Amazon didn't just come out of nowhere. They had to knock some people off. And the biggest gorilla at that time was Bookstacks Unlimited, and I was their internet marketing guy. So I couldn't very well turn my back on them and align myself with Amazon. But so in 1993, I think it was, I put online the first time a publisher ever had their book catalog on the internet was Loom Panics. And we had it on a thing called the Gopher server. There was an intermediate technology basically between just bulletin board and then a website, and it was called the Gopher. And it was like a very librarianish way of organizing content into hierarchical silos and that you could access over the internet. So we were able to get our whole catalog online with all our book descriptions in a Gopher server that at the time was better than anything like Random House or Simon Schuster or Thomson Reuters had done on the internet. So we were sort of ahead of it. And, you know, you had the euphoria. You might remember this euphoria in those days that this was the great leveler, that the playing field was now leveled, that Loom Panics, Little Loom Panics in Port Townsend, Washington, could now compete on an equal basis with big old Random House back in New York, New York, and that the internet was going to make all information free, and it was going to make little people as big as big people. And it was just this sort of halcyon days where we thought the new utopia had come and the internet was going to launch it. And so Bookstacks Unlimited had built a substantial business creating Gopher servers for publishers and also operating at the time one of the largest Gopher servers for their book catalog. And you could log into Bookstacks Unlimited and order and surf their Gopher servers and order books online and have them mailed to you. And they were also very fast to get into the shift to the graphical user interface of the web. But along came Amazon. And in 95, Jeff Bezos called and asked me if I would be interested in coming in to talk to him about the job of marketing director for Amazon. So he thought he had a job that was big enough to lure me away. He must have known I was working for his main competitor. And I did then. It's about a three-hour journey from Port Townsend to Seattle, involving a ferry across Puget Sound. And I got there, and I went down to where Amazon's headquarters was at the time. There's an old Sears building in the what they called SoDo, south of the Dome area of Seattle. And it was mostly industrial warehouses. Very definitely not a nice place to have to go work, except that you have plenty of parking. You just worry that your car would get broken into. And so there was Jeff. He was on the second floor, so he only had the second floor of what looked like a warehouse on the first floor, truck bays and things like that. And he had about a suite of about six rooms. There was a guy on the floor wiring computers together. When I got there, I found out that was his IT guy, maybe number two or three hired. There was one person at reception. There was a person in back taking orders and packing, one person taking orders and packing books. And then Jeff's office was just a little, I would say, 12 by 12. His desk was a door over two file cabinets, a hollow core door, and that sort of became, for a while, a thing at Amazon. Later, every new hire had to build their own desk, so they had to go down to the warehouse and get their desk and assemble
themselves. What year was this, Steve? What roughly when was this?
The year that I met him was 95, and then we went to lunch. And he tried to explain what Amazon was trying to do. And then I went home and I told my wife that the salary was bad, but there are stock options. And she said, and I quote, "Worthless stock options?" She did not want me to take a job that involved lowering my pay and getting stock options, which she didn't, she had no idea. And I have to admit, it wasn't, stock options at that time weren't what they became in just a few years. You know, everybody was talking about having options. And so it was still something relatively new and as a form of compensation. And I called Jeff. I sent him an email. I still have it, declining to accept the position. And then...
Well, also, Steve, let me just for perspective for listeners, also for your own perspective, in 95... the idea of any internet business being in business a year later was pretty slim. You know, you happened to be with a pretty stable company at the time, and you know they had a good business model, and they were making money, and they could pay your salary. But the idea of a new guy, you know, working with a door on his as a desk,
it was very sketchy. And he was trying to knock off some pretty heavy people. And I think the thing that got me at the time that was the deal breaker was, you know, I'm a book guy. I'm a writer, and I'm come up through publishers. And really most of my online stuff has been helping book authors, publishers, et cetera. And there was no love for books there. In other words, I could tell that books was to him just what he thought would succeed first. So... even at that time, his vision was much more all-encompassing than anyone I'd ever met regarding the internet. And he sort of knew that it wasn't just going to be books. But you'll recall it was years and years before Amazon was known for anything except books. It was Earth's biggest bookstore. That used to be their tagline, bookstore, you know, not everything store.
Meanwhile, other companies like Yahoo and Netscape were catching fire, you know, and Amazon was just sort of
not, I won't say it was a backwater, but it wasn't a big deal. Hey, I wonder if you could talk about every year Bezos would invite you to come over to the office and you got to see the office expand year by year. Could you tell people
That was something else, because in 95, when I went to interview with him, he was in these fairly modest, rustic accommodations in the bad part of town. And then the next year I went, and he had moved into a bank building downtown. And so we had lunch together, and he showed me around the offices there. And then the next year I went back, and he had the whole floor of that bank building. He enjoyed walking me from department to department. He'd say, and this is the accounting department, and this is the fulfillment, and, you know, and this is the advertising, and you'd see, you know, half a dozen people at desks in each of these departments. And then the next year I met with him, he had like 8 floors of the bank building. He'd gone from 1 floor to 8 floors. And then I moved to New Orleans in 1998, and I didn't see him again for a couple of years. I went in to pitch him the author views company that I had, you know, building trailers of authors talking about their books, and I had to go to Seattle to do this pitch. And when I got there, we took a car to Amazon, and at that time they had this headquarters. They had bought an old hospital, and they were on like their own mountaintop. It was sort of surreal because you would drive and there's nothing else there except this almost like, it almost looks like the Emerald City, you know, this hospital converted into Amazon.com, and the executives had their own floor up there. I forget what it was, 7th floor or something, and we went and pitched to them there. They didn't end up doing any business with us, but then I heard like the next year or the year after, they went and bought, basically, they moved to Union, I think it's called Union Bay or Union Park. They now have a whole campus, obviously. It's not just one of those buildings. It's like several of those size buildings. So here this man has gone from, really, I would have been, I think, hire number 6 at Amazon. And I saw just yesterday, I think, where they said that they have 30,000 positions open at Amazon. They're looking to hire 30,000. They have 30,000 vacancies right now. From 6 people. 6 people in 1995. I think
Can I ask you a question? Bezos and company were very good at picking your brain, weren't they? I mean, didn't they always have questions for you about what you were up to, what you were doing? And
oh, yes. And in the early days, I knew it was good to court his favor. So I provided a lot of content that was used on the early Amazon site for publishers and authors about how they can promote their books on the internet, because it was important to Amazon that authors and publishers promote online. And so he wanted help resources for them. And I provided virtually all of those help resources for years that were on the Amazon site. I don't know, that may still be there now, you know, explaining to authors how to do book announcements and excerpts and how to do email news releases and that sort of thing. Then we talked frequently in those early years because I was always representing a publisher, one publisher or another. A funny story about Bookstacks Unlimited. They said, at one point they said, Amazon is losing $1 million a month. They're not going to be around much longer. And it was right at that time. I don't know if it was 97 or what it was, and they were losing $1 million every month, and their shareholders were furious, and it looked like, you know, the vultures were circling, and they did an IPO, and they got $360 million in the IPO. And I turned to the people at Bookstacks and I said, geez, they'll just be dead in only another 60 months. You know, they obviously now had enough money to last another 6 years and lose $1 million a month. And they still wouldn't run out of money. And so when that happened, when they saw that Wall Street would finance this horribly money-losing company and say, keep going, Jeff, you know, lose some more for us, they knew that they didn't have the stomach to compete. And so they closed and they sold, they owned the domain books.com and they sold that to Barnes & Noble for $1 million.
Oh, okay.
That book in the book stacks. They became a domain name and that was the most valuable thing left.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Hey, Steve, so we're going to wrap it up and I want to remind people that Steve is a writer and he's got a great book out that's, I think I've told you before privately, I'll say it publicly. This book is a classic. It's going to stand the test of time. I'll say that. It's called Set the Page on Fire. And it says, you know, it's the secrets of successful writers, but it really is. It's one of the most practical, useful, and inspiring books on writing that I've ever read. And I, like I've said earlier, I think before we started the recording, that I routinely buy it and give it to friends who are already professional writers. And I've yet to find anybody that wasn't thrilled by it. So if you're a person who likes to write, would like to write and be published, or even if you are an active professional writer with decades under your belt, this is a wonderful book. It's short, it's sweet, it's a gem. And I know that you've been working on it before you published it for many, many years. And now, do you continue to provide services to authors and people who want to get publicity on the internet?
I do. I take on about, now I've kind of slowed down. I don't have this big operation like I used to with 9 employees. So I take on about 4 books a year is about all I can handle. So roughly 1 per season. And I've worked with authors in all different stages. And you know, we have an author that you just tipped to me, Sandy Rosenthal, down at levies.org. And now she's only been working with me now for about 6 weeks. But last week she got a very generous offer to publish her book on levies, on the levy failure in New Orleans. And I am just so absolutely excited and thrilled and doing somersaults for her because, you know, that's what I like to see. I work with authors at even before they're published sometimes and often after they're published. And I do things now like producing podcasts and related to books, things similar to this podcast, and also the standard news releases and book PR, you know, making sure you have a decent, I hate to use the word press kit, but it is still called a press kit for your book. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, the press kit's a little different. It contains things like metadata that people need in order to properly slice and dice your book and categorize it and find it on the internet. I do Amazon page makeovers for people. So if you're unhappy with your presence on Amazon, there's a way to fix that. And so I provide both instructions at my website and also services, and you can find that at steve-o'keefe.com. And there's no apostrophe in the URL. It's just steve-o-k-e-e-f-e.
Great. Well, Steve, thank you so much for sharing your story. You know, I'll say this as somebody who's been involved in the commercial side of the internet since before there was a commercial side to the internet. I've always found you to be one of the leading lights in what's now going to sound like a quaint term, but the movement to commercialize the internet. Clearly the movement's come and succeeded, but I remember how just essential your very existence was. The fact that here was a guy that was willing to say, I'm going to make my full-time living doing promotional things on the internet. That was such a bold step, and it's great that the world responded so positively to it. And thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. And I, you know, you have led me to many good books. Scientific Advertising is one that you referred me to. And over the years, your contributions have informed everything that I advise people on the internet, from the style that they use in an email when they're approaching a journalist. I very much have learned from you to keep it short and to keep it tidy. And also, you know, you have something called the system. I don't know if you're still doing this or not, but it was, what is somebody supposed to do when they have a talent and they want to commercialize it? And you provide this sort of roadmap, which goes from providing everything from a free flyer explaining whatever the service is to a franchise business opportunity. And this system of having something at every price range for every customer, that I felt like was an original contribution of yours that is now sort of considered like duh, you know, like it's sort of like standard marketing practice that one generates multiple streams of income by providing things at different price points. And, you know, now, like I say, people take this stuff for granted, but it really was folks like you and me and Eric Ward out at the very beginning. Jill Ellsworth, who I can't get through this conversation without mentioning her, she wrote the book Marketing on the Internet and the book Education on the Internet, and she was part of Microsoft's initial, you know, MS.com or whatever it was, their Microsoft's Internet Strategy Committee. And she passed away way too young of cancer, probably around 1999. And, you know, she really paved the way for me. And she was one of those like you that was there at the beginning, and they had a good heart, and they were trying to figure out how to use this thing. Now, guys like Kanner and Siegel, they didn't have a good heart. They were blunt force, you know. They went at the Internet to try to exploit as much as they could and to make people stop them. You know, and you and I and Jill Ellsworth and Eric Ward, we were like, you know, there's a way to do this that can be done without getting everybody upset and that achieves value creation for the people on the receiving end and value creation for the people on the selling or giving end. And as long as you can limit your message to those people who are most likely to be interested in it, you're providing a service, you're not a scourge. And so I'm proud to be a member of this club that Kent Stark thinks are worth interviewing about this, and proud to be a member of this early group that tried to tell people what we had found in terms of what would and wouldn't work there.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Steve O'Keefe, thank you very much.